Okay, now how many guys are making New Year's resolutions? Anybody? A few of you? Okay, nice. Anybody have one they'd like to share? No? Okay, fine. They're private resolutions. Yeah. Nice. So, and how are you going to fulfill that resolution? Not grow. And how are you going to stop yourself from growing? Drink weed killer or something? I don't know. That would probably stop you from growing, but it'd probably also stop you from living. So you might not want to go that route. I don't know. But today we're going to talk about, instead of, put a little twist on that, instead of a New Year's resolution, we're going to talk about having a New Year's revolution, okay? And now, does anybody know how you would define resolution? What it is? Anybody have any ideas? Okay, dictionary defines it as this. A resolution is a firm decision. Basically, it's something where you are resolved or resolute to do something. You have an idea in your mind, and it's a firm idea that you've come up with, okay? Now, resolution is good. It's a good thing. You have to start with an idea. But a lot of times, a resolution is kind of where it stops. It starts with an idea, and a lot of times, unfortunately, for people, it ends with an idea. So that's why I want to talk about having a New Year's revolution. Let's look at the definition of that. The dictionary defines it as a sudden or momentous change in a situation. So you kind of got to start with the resolution, an idea, a strong idea of what you want to change. But a revolution is what makes you take action and to revolt against whatever issue it is. Okay. Now, how many of you guys can guess how many Americans will make, are projected to make a New Year's resolution tomorrow, January 1st, 2007? Any ideas how many people will do it? A billion Americans. Okay. How many? What do you guys think? What?
A lot.
That's very specific. Good. What were you going to say? A million? Okay. It's actually 45 million Americans that people say that statistically will make a resolution on January 1st, 2007. That's tomorrow. Now, how many of you guys can guess in percentages how many of those resolutions statistically will be broken by February 1st, 2007, 1 month later? 80%? 2%? Okay. Any other guesses? 90%? Bingo. He wins. 90%. In 1 month, statistically, 90% of all New Year's resolutions will be broken. Can you believe that? January 1st, 2007. Everybody's like, oh, man. I'm fat. I got to get to the gym. That's my New Year's resolution, right? Here's my New Year's resolution. I'm going to stop eating 1,000 tacos every time I sit down to eat. And I'm going to go to the gym. And I'm going to quit smoking. All right? That's what everybody says. I guess if you have those problems. Anyways, so they make these resolutions. And January 1st, 2007, they're like, sweet. I'm on a taco diet. I'm not eating them, all right? Going to the gym. I'm not smoking. Whatever the resolution may be. Well, come February 1st, 2007, 90%, 9 out of those 10 people will have already broken their resolutions and be back to eating tacos or not going to the gym or smoking, all right? Isn't that sad? People break their resolutions all the time. And that's why I think it's important, instead of us having a New Year's resolution, an idea of what we want to do. Instead, I think it's important for us to cause a New Year's revolution, completely revolting against an issue in our lives. Now, here's what I want you guys to do. We're going to talk about this morning, and what I want you guys to do right now is take like a minute, okay? Quit playing with each other's hair. Take a minute and think of an issue in your life that could probably be better, okay? Now, be serious about this. This is a serious thing. Maybe it's a problem with a family member. Maybe it's a problem with respect. You don't respect your elders. Maybe it's, for whatever reason, it's something that you're always getting in trouble for. Maybe it's you have a bad habit of cheating on a test. Or you're hanging out with the wrong people you know you shouldn't. Or you're listening to the wrong music. Whatever it may be. Think for a minute of something that could be better in your life, all right? If you want to write it down, that would be cool. But think for a minute, what could be better? And you're not going to have to share this, so be honest, all right? What would it be? Okay, get that thing in your mind, and I want you guys to be thinking about that today as we discuss, as we learn from a really cool Bible story. It's a story that's rarely shared, and if you haven't read the book of Judges, you may have not heard of it. So I'm looking forward to it. So it's about a guy named Ehud, okay? Now I know you guys really like that name, and I know you guys were all planning on naming your sons that once you got married and stuff, right? Ehud. But Ehud, how many of you guys are left-handed? Anybody in this room? Lefty, lefty, lefty. Nice. The lefties are representing today. Last service, it was me and Chris. And we're all, oh, sweet, I hope the righties don't beat us up. But they didn't, thankfully. So, yeah, they were all scared of us. So, left-handers, the reason I ask is because Ehud, our buddy in the story today, is a lefty. And we're going to learn how that works out for his benefit. So let's go ahead and start reading, see kind of what's going on here. I'll give you some background on the book of Judges here in just a minute. Judges chapter 3, we'll start reading in verse 12. If you don't have a Bible, make sure you share with somebody and follow along. And the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord strengthened Eglon, king of Moab, against Israel because they had done evil in the sight of the Lord. Then he gathered to himself the people of Ammon and Amalek, went and defeated Israel and took possession of the city of Palms. So the children of Israel served Eglon, king of Moab, 18 years. Okay, now, who knows the book that comes before the book of Judges? What is it?
Joshua.
Very nice. You get 3 bonus points for that. Yeah, congratulations on that. So Joshua, okay, so right before the book of Judges, we know that Joshua has been in charge of the nation of Israel. And before Joshua, what were some things that happened? Right now, obviously, we're studying Genesis on the weekends. Actually, not really right now, but we're studying Genesis. We've been learning about creation and the flood and all that stuff. Then comes Exodus. What happens in Exodus? Anybody know? How about the Exodus, right? They exit Egypt. And you guys are on top of it today. You guys are doing good. So they exit Egypt, and that's the Exodus. And then they have the books of the law. They write, God gives them laws and different things. So then comes Joshua. Then comes Judges. And unfortunately, the book of Judges is kind of a good and a bad book because you don't really like to read a lot of the stuff that goes on in Judges because Israel has this bad habit of hanging out with the wrong people, marrying the wrong people, and they end up living in sin and falling into idolatry and eventually judgment by God. Okay, so they get into this bad habit. God says, here's the people that you shouldn't hang out with. Don't mess with them because they'll mess you up, basically, is what God says. So Israel says, okay, good idea. I don't think we're going to follow that. And so they start doing whatever they want to do. They start intermarrying with these different nations. They start hanging out with them. Eventually, they're worshiping idols. They've become selfish, ungodly people. So then what does God do? God judges them. And he brings a nation that comes and defeats Israel and brings them into captivity or something. So then they serve this evil king for years. And then they finally get smart. And they're like, life was so good when we were serving God. Let's cry out to God. So they cry out to God. God, we're so sorry. Oh, we've been so evil. Come and save us. So then God raises up what we call, and where the book got its name, a judge. He raises up a judge, and there's different people. There's Deborah, there's Gideon, the guy that we're going to read about, Ehud. There's different guys, different women that God raises up to judge the nation of Israel and bring them back to him, okay? So these judges are important, but they get in this habit, and the judge comes, saves them from the evil king, and they serve the Lord, and everything's good for a little while. And then eventually they go back to their old ways. They're living in sin. Everything gets bad. They cry out to God. God brings up a judge. The judge saves them. They serve God. Then they eventually go back to their old sinful ways. God judges them. It's just this terrible downward spiral. And that's where we catch up with Israel. And so the next judge in line is this guy named Ehud. God raises him up and he says, you need to save my people from this evil king Eglon, all right? So we're going to see three things that Ehud did that are important for us to do as well when we're facing an issue. And especially as we talk about this idea of a New Year's revolution, all right? So the first thing that he did was, number one, he assessed the situation. He looked around. He came up with an idea. He knew kind of what the problem was. Let's see what happens. Verse 15. But when the children of Israel cried out to the Lord raised up a deliverer for them, Ehud, the son of Gera, the Benjamite, a left-handed man. By him the children of Israel sent tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Now Ehud made himself a dagger. It was double-edged and a cubit in length, and fastened it under his clothes on his right thigh. Okay, now you're like, that's really weird. Why do we care that he's left-handed? Why do we care that he made a dagger and put it on his right thigh? That's weird. Okay, let me explain to you why that's a big deal. Well, first of all, most people in these times, even like today, there's not a lot of lefties. Just like in this room, there's probably five of us, and there's probably 30 right-handers. So the lefties were rarely considered good warriors or anything like that. It was mainly right-handed people that would fight in battle. So what they would do was they would make themselves daggers, just like Ehud did, but they would put it on their left thigh. They would maybe make like a strap. You guys have probably seen like those armbands that you can stick your iPod in or something to go running, right? Well, maybe it's something like that. You stick your sword in there to go running, you know? But it's around your left thigh. Because when you're right-handed, you want to reach across like this to pull out your sword and go to battle really easily. It's harder to reach over here than it is across your body to go into battle. So your right side was the side that everybody checked. Okay, now like when you guys go to the airport, they'll make you take off your shoes because who knows, there might be a bomb in your shoes, you know. Or they'll like wand you down. I remember one time I was at the airport, and you guys have probably done this sometime. You go in and out of the little security thing, and it beeps every time. You're like, I don't know what it is, you know. So they have to take you to the special station and pull out the wand and like wave it all over you, you know. I remember one time I had a Coke with me. And the woman was like, it kept beeping. And so she had to wand me down. She's waving it all over. And she even waves it on the Coke. And I was like, yeah, like there's a bomb in the Coke. And she's all, excuse me, sir, we don't joke around here, all right? And I was like, all right, I'm sorry. I'm not going to blow you up or anything. Never mind. I shouldn't have said that, right? Well, so they a lot of times in the Bible, they would also try to find weapons on people. Especially when you would approach a king, they would make sure you didn't have a gun, a knife, you know, a dagger, something hidden that you might try to assassinate the king with. But why would they check your right-hand side? There's no lefties. You don't have to worry about that. They would only check the left-hand side because that's where somebody would hide a sword, is on your right thigh. So they'd pat you down. If they couldn't feel anything, no big deal. You go see the king. They would never check the right-hand side. So Ehud comes up with this idea. He's like, you know what? God has empowered me. This big king Eglon is this evil guy. And he assesses the situation. He makes a plan. He makes a dagger. It says that it's a cubit in length. That means it's about 18 inches long. All right? So it's a good size little sword thing. All right? And sharp. Two edges, it says. And so he makes it. He puts it on his right thigh. And he goes to the king. He assesses the situation. Well, second of all, number two, he attacked the source. Look at verse 17. So he brought the tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. This is my favorite part. Now Eglon was a very fat man. Nice. You like that? I'm glad that they added that in there, you know, because it just makes the story funner. Eglon was really fat. Okay, that's okay. We like that. Verse 18, and when he had finished presenting the tribute, he sent away the people who had carried the tribute. But he himself turned back from the stone images that were at Gilgal and said, I have a secret message for you, O king. He said, keep silence. And all who attended him went out from him. So Ehud came to him Now he was sitting upstairs in his cool private chamber. Then Ehud said, I have a message from God for you. So he arose from his seat. Okay, now try to picture the story here. Ehud's like, hey, dude, I got to go to the king. So he makes this sword, two edges, really sharp, 18 inches long, puts it on his right thigh because he knows nobody's going to check there. Goes to the king, brings him this gift from the people. And then he's leaving and he says, oh yeah, hey king, I have a secret. And you know kings, they love secrets, right? And so the king's like, oh, sweet. Everybody get out of here. He's got to tell me a secret, all right? And so he says, Ehud, come up here. Yeah, I mean, you got to whisper it because we don't want anybody else to know this secret, right? So he says, yeah, because this is, Ehud says, King Eglon, this is from God, all right? This is a pretty big secret here. So he gets up the king gets out of his throne and he goes to whisper to him. Well, check out what he does. Verse 21, then Ehud reached with his left hand, took the dagger from his right thigh, shing, and thrust it into his belly. Even the hilt, or the handle, went in after the blade, and the fat closed over the blade, for he did not draw the dagger out of his belly, and his entrails came out. Nice. All the girls were all, ugh, all the guys were all, sweet. That's awesome. Verse 23, then Ehud went out through the porch and shut the doors of the upper room behind him and locked them. So this guy's pretty smart. He's like, hey, king, I got a secret. And the king's like, all right, come tell it to me. He's like, here's the secret. Shing! You know, thrust it into his belly, it says, all the way in, so much so that the handle went in, and it says the fat wrapped around the sword, and it stayed in the man's belly, all right? He stabs him, and Ehud's like, there's your message. You can probably keep that. I got to go. I'm out, you know? He runs out, locks the doors behind him, probably waves hi to the messengers. Hey, guys, have a nice day. I'm taking off. Runs home. He attacked the source, all right? He knew the source of the problem for Israel was this evil king. And so he attacked. He went up to this king, thrust the sword in, kept the sword in the man, and left, locked the doors. Well, let's find out what happens next. Verse 24, when he had gone out, Eglon's servants came to look. And to their surprise, the doors of the upper room were locked. So they said, he is probably attending to his needs in the cool chamber. So they waited till they were embarrassed. And still he had not opened the doors of the upper room. Therefore they took the key and opened them. And there was their master, fallen dead on the floor. So Ehud runs out, locks the doors. The messengers are like, I guess we'll wait until he invites us back in. They hang around, twiddling their thumbs. They played hangman and tic-tac-toe and hopscotch and all that stuff, right? And then finally, they ran out of games and they're like, you know what? He must be asleep. They open the door. There he is, entrails out on the floor, bloody, fallen down, dead. And they're probably so embarrassed that they allowed their king to go through this. And by this time, Ehud's gone. He's all the way back home. Well, there's a third important thing that Ehud did. First of all, you remember, he assessed the situation, then he attacked the source, but now he announces the success. Okay, look at verse 26. But Ehud had escaped while they delayed and passed beyond the stone images and escaped to Syria. And it happened when he arrived that he blew the trumpet in the mountains of Ephraim, and the children of Israel went down with him from the mountains, and he led them. Then he said, follow me, for the Lord has delivered your enemies, the Moabites, into your hand. So they went down after him, seized the fords of the Jordan, leading to Moab, and did not allow anyone to cross over. And at that time they killed about 10,000 men of Moab, all stout men of valor, not a man escaped. So Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the land had rest for 80 years. So God gives him this victory, and then he runs back home, and he announces it to the people. He says, hey guys, we had this problem. Not anymore. I left my sword in him, okay? He's like, guys, God's given us the victory. Let's go kill our enemies. So it says they went out, they killed 10,000 men. It says these were stout men of valor, okay? These were like the big dudes, the big muscle guys like me, okay? And why do you laugh? That's kind of mean. Anyways, I'm just kidding. Anyways, they attacked their enemies, kill 10,000 of them, and it says that they were given rest for 80 years. So let's think about this, how it relates to us. Remember I had you think of that problem in your life, the issue that you're dealing with. How can we learn from Ehud? Well, the first thing, we need to assess the situation. We need to think about why it's causing us a problem and how we can fix it. We need to come up with a plan. And that's exactly what Ehud did. But the next step is important because without it, it's just a resolution. It's just an idea. But we need to take the next step to cause a revolution. We need to revolt. We need to attack the source of the problem. Okay? Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying you need to go kill a fat guy to get rid of your problems. Right? That's not what I'm getting at. Don't do that. Don't kill anybody. Okay? But what you do need to do is attack the problem in your life at its source. And that's different for all of us. We each have different problems. We each have different sources of those problems. And you need to attack it at that source. Maybe it's your computer that's causing problems in your life. Turn it off. Get it out of your room. Take it, throw it off a bridge, you know, whatever you got to do, right? Or maybe it's a friend, a person that you're hanging out with that you know you shouldn't be. They're starting to change the way you think and act and talk. Get away from them. Don't kill them, but get away from them. Maybe it's music that you're listening to. I've been there. I've been affected by music. I remember hearing time after time of my youth pastor and my parents telling me that I shouldn't be listening to the music that I listened to. It finally took God getting a hold of me, and I remember one time I took my whole CD case. I probably had 38, 40 CDs in there, packed in there, and I went to the dumpster and I broke them all and threw them away in the dumpster. I attacked the problem at its source. And then Ehud goes home and he announces the success. He tells his family and his friends, look what God has done. You know what I think is even better than that? Is starting by announcing to your family or to some of your close friends of what you're going to do, okay? It's important because maybe you want to get past a struggle or an issue in your life. I hope that you do. One of the best ways to do it is to ask somebody for help. Find a good friend. Find a velocity leader. Find a parent that you can trust and say, hey, here's the thing. I'm dealing with this issue. I'm struggling with this sin. But in 2007, I am revolting against it. I'm going to cause a revolution. And I'm not going to do it anymore. Will you help me with that? That means you have to be open. When they ask you, hey, how's it going? You got to be honest. If you're not doing so great, tell them. They want to help you. You need to announce it to those people. So it's important. And I hope my prayer for you guys is that God will point out something in your life that could be better and give you the power to fix it. He's given us all the power to fix it. In fact, his word tells us that. 1 Corinthians 10:13. You can write that down, or it'll be right up here on the screen for you. 1 Corinthians 10:13 says, no temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it. In other words, the temptation that you have in your life, the struggle that you're dealing with, you can never use the excuse, I can't help it. I can't stop. Because you can. Every time you make the wrong decision or the right decision, it's a decision you've made. And you need to understand that. It's time to revolt against the issues in our lives. And instead of just having a resolution, cause a revolution in your life and change something. All right? Why don't we close in prayer? God, we just thank you so much that you have promised that you've given us everything that we need to combat different issues and temptations and struggles in our lives. God, I pray that you would give us the power and the strength that we need to go against those, to stand up for what we believe. And this year, instead of just having a good idea of what we should do and making a New Year's resolution, God, I pray that you would help us to cause a revolution in our lives, that we would revolt and we would attack the problem at its source. We would seek out family and friends to help us. And Lord, we know that in the end, you'll receive the glory because you're so good and you're using us. So God, I pray for each of these students in this room as we leave today, help us to be safe. But God, I pray most of all, spiritually, they would be strong in you. And although as we're driving around today, we slip all over the place in our cars and our feet slip sometimes, the foundation's not strong. It's slippery. God, I pray that our spiritual foundation would be strong in you and would be focused completely on you. God, we love you. Thank you so much for bringing us here. In your name we pray. Amen. Thank you.